Well, thank you all for having me. It's an honor to be here. And this is certainly a different crowd than I'm accustomed to speaking with, be it from my work in Olympia, Washington, with the Rachel Corrie Foundation, who helps me immensely with my research, or be it in the Association of American Geographers, which is also a slightly different audience in terms of reception. What I want to talk to you guys about is why geographers are interested in this whole issue, in this whole process. And I think one of the things we can talk about perhaps during question and answer is our success and our failures within the discipline. But I want to first give you sort of a background in terms of, again, as Professor Lubin discussed, why members of the ASA would be interested. I want to talk to you about the specifically geographical concerns, particularly since geography is being used now within so many other disciplines, particularly GIS and other forms of spatial analysis. Why then geographers in particular would be so interested? In my research, I look at occupation as a set of spatial practices. And so what this means is it's not an event, it's not something that occurred simply in 1948 or 1967, but it's something that's ongoing and deeply dynamic, which is how it has managed to sustain itself for so long. There's a large body of literature within geography which analyzes the processes that are going on in places like Palestine. Perhaps most salient is this notion of accumulation by dispossession, which is David Harvey's analysis of how societies are exploited. In addition, we also have a tradition of social justice within critical geography, particularly within critical geography. And finally, part of the notions that I use is this notion of everyday incarceration and panopticism, which is provided by occupation practice. Now, looking back a little bit historically, Friedrich Ratzel was a German geographer who talked about the way a state should behave, the proper behavior of a state. And he imagined a state as an organic organism that had to constantly expand at the risk of, if not expanding, then it would collapse and die. And one of the things that's most interesting to me as a political geographer is to see the way that Israel has actually taken this process of continual expansion and used it essentially as its method of survival. So we can see here, these are maps taken from Gershon Shafir's text, which is looking at the origins of land labor and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And you can see in the first map, it shows you the first settlements that were created by Zionists in Palestine beginning in 1878. And by 1918, you can see already there's been an expansion process. Now, as this process goes on, you can see in 1947, the United Nations proposed a division between what would become a Palestinian state and what would become Israel. You can see the proposal was essentially 50-50, even though that didn't represent the division of the population at the time, which was more like 90% Palestinian and 10% what would become Israelis. But as you can see then, by 1967, the Israeli state had expanded significantly, largely through a process of razing and destroying villages. Over 500 Palestinian villages destroyed, largely in the first 10 years since 1947. With the peace process, you can see this process continues. By 1967, 20% of the territory that was historical Palestine, made up of Gaza and the West Bank, this would be considered the future Palestinian state. By 1995, the argument was now you had to divide that 20% even further into areas A, B, and C, which would leave the future Palestinian autonomous authority with between 18 and 20% of the original 20%. Of the entire territory of the region, right? So you can see that from the Palestinian perspective, you see this constant expansion, this constant expansion of the Israeli state. And of course, it does so through the creation of settlements, and settlements being the largest sticking point, all of which, by the way, that are built in the 1967 occupied Palestinian territories are illegal under international law. And the vast majority of them, as the Israeli newspaper Haaretz has pointed out on numerous occasions, are actually illegal under Israeli law. Now, in addition to the actual, the large-scale expansion that you see, you actually see villages and towns themselves being impacted and shrinking under this process of Israeli expansion. So this is a map produced by the village, or the town of Qalqilya, which is a Palestinian city in the West Bank, and you can see there are these concentric shapes. And the largest shape is the historical territory of Qalqilya. In 1948, as Israel expanded, it took the most the most fertile agricultural land and the most productive wells and took them into the Israeli state. And then over time, the actual territory that's controlled by Qalqilya has gotten smaller and smaller, and this is again being decided unilaterally by the Israeli government. And when we talk about expansion and why, and again, I want you to think as geographers for just a moment and why space is so important, what you find is the vast majority of both of settlements and the wall that protect them are largely about maintaining control of the water resources on the West Bank. And this is a map which shows you the most productive aquifers in the West Bank, and you'll see through the Oslo Peace Accords, right? This is the agreement that was signed between Israel and the nascent Palestinian Authority at the time. The most productive area is the Western Basin, and you can see there that it can produce 362 million cubic meters of water per year. And then, as you see under the Oslo Accords, Israel is then given 340 million cubic meters of water per year, and 22 is the maximum allowed to the Palestinian Authority from this most productive aquifer. Now, one of the things to keep in mind about this, Palestinians never extract 22%, or 22 million cubic meters, rather. They were never able to actually achieve this number because in 1967, the Israeli Occupation Authority passed a law banning all wells built by Palestinians in the West Bank. So any well that a Palestinian wants to produce has to be approved by the Palestinian military authority, and this includes new parts for existing wells or even the maintenance of a well that's already in place, which explains why many of these wells are using wellheads from the 1950s that have never been replaced. So much of the discussion about boycott revolves around this notion of apartheid. Now, apartheid, of course, in Afrikaans means racial separation. And I think for geographers, this is particularly important in terms of understanding why we use this term when we talk about the region. Largely, it's about, first of all, you have the construction of settlements. Now, settlements are Jewish-only towns and infrastructure, right? If you're a Palestinian, you're unable to live in a settlement. You can't buy land there if you wanted to. And in many cases on the West Bank, it's actually illegal to enter. Many workers will go illegally because it's the only work there is. You also have dual court systems, right? In the same territory, in the same place, two people commit the same crime. If you're Jewish and you commit the crime, you go to a civil court. If you're Palestinian in the same place and commit the same crime, you go to a military court. And one of the features of this military court system is something called administrative detention. Administrative detention is imprisonment for 6 months without trial. And it's imprisonment for 6 months without charge. So there's a blanket charge given to Palestinians called khatara ila mantaka in Arabic, which means a danger to the region. Many Palestinians that are in administrative detention have been there for 10 and 15 years, and they don't know the reason that they're in prison. They've never been told the actual charges or the reason that they're there. Within this system, you also have a system of labor separation. So for Israeli workers as opposed to Palestinian workers, Palestinians have no protections. They're not covered under Israeli labor law, and there's a permit system they have to apply for. Any Palestinian with any arrest history is banned from getting a permit to enter Israel to work. You have an economic strangulation, which is Professor Lubin has already mentioned. So there's a de facto boycott of the Palestinian economy, and Palestinians are seen as a surplus population and subject to collective punishment. So, again, I'm a geographer guy, so I like maps. So this is a map from UN OCHA, OPT. It's the UN office which primarily makes maps and coordinates relief efforts in the region. So you can see the areas that we're talking about here, Gaza Strip on the Mediterranean, and then the West Bank, which is this small area against the Jordan. So, in my own research, I've essentially developed five models of occupation. This is how occupation functions. So, in the West Bank, you have the city of Al-Khalil, or Hebron, where you have a vertical occupation. And what this means is you actually have settlers lifting their homes on top of Palestinian homes, drilling down into the Palestinian homes and kicking out the families house by house. In Jerusalem, particularly in the regions where I was working, Sheikh Jarrah, you have an occupation that's modeled after Hebron. And there's actually this verbal communication between Palestinians and settlers that are saying, Palestinians saying, you can't do this here, this isn't Hebron, which I think is an interesting phenomenon. Again, you have dispossession house by house, a slow isolation and takeover of villages. In Qalqilya, you have what's called a lateral occupation, where the settlements expand laterally. You don't see settlers within the Palestinian towns themselves, but you see them cut off by the expansion of settlements around and through the closure of villages. In Jordan Valley, you have massive agricultural settlements and a military closure, when that military closure, again, only applies to Palestinians. If you're Israeli, you're not subject to this closure. And then Gaza, you have complete incarceration and the siege. Professor Seuss has mentioned here, this is probably the most common point of interaction between Palestinians and Israelis at this point in the 1967 territories. This is a particular checkpoint called Hawara. You can see it's dramatically technologized, it's very much militarized, and this is this point, and this focal point of conflict which occurs in terms of the everyday lives of Palestinians. Here we have a photo of a family which has been driven out of their home from this house-to-house process in Jerusalem. This is the village of Azun, which in 2009 was shut down unilaterally by the Israeli military. You can see the only entrance to this village is now blocked by a concrete berm, so no cars can go in. If you want to come out, you have to walk out of the village, and you can only carry whatever you can take on your back. And this, of course, is in the process of allowing more room for Israeli settlers that are taking over both the farmland and the territory around. So one of the claims, then, about the problems here is that this is an issue of water. It's the Middle East. It's an arid place. It's a desert. There's no water to go around. But as this infographic points out to you, Ramallah actually gets more water than London does. Right? You have 619 millimeters of water falling per year in Ramallah. So where does all of this water go? Right? If the problem is not simply a question of quantity, but where does the water go? And as I pointed out, there is this deeply unequal distribution of water. Now, water being something immensely important in terms of health for anyone, anywhere. So as you can see from this infographic, it's kind of hard to see, but Palestinians on average receive 70 liters of water per day on the West Bank. The minimum from the World Health Organization is 100 liters of water per day. Israeli settlers receive 300 liters of water per day. So three times the minimum required by the WHO, and also a number which rivals the United States and many European countries as well. So there is this incredibly unequal distribution of water, largely driven by processes such as the state-owned Israeli water company and the ban on the production of water for Palestinians. So this is the West Bank, but one of the things that I think is important to talk about is Gaza, and Gaza is something that makes the news fairly regularly. This is a shot of Erez checkpoint. It's the only checkpoint, actually, where people can go in and out of Gaza legally. So you have certified NGO workers and special permits for the gravely sick and injured. The other terminals are officially closed by the Egyptians. This changes from time to time. And this is really the only way in and out of the territory. As you can see, Gaza is surrounded by a concrete wall, which is peppered with 50-caliber gun emplacements, which are automated, as well as gun towers. So it looks very much like a prison. So it not only acts like a prison, but it actually looks like a prison as well. One of the major complaints that Gazans have is this thing called the no-go zone, which is enforced by the Israelis. And what you see here is, this is again from the United Nations, they're providing you with satellite photos, one from 2003 and one from 2008. When the no-go zone was first enforced. The no-go zone came into effect in 2006. And what you can see here is a total collapse of the agricultural sector. So in the no-go zone, this is 30% of the arable land for Gaza, which is now off-limits. Right? So Palestinians aren't even allowed into this area. It's the most fertile agricultural land within Gaza. And so what this does then is this creates, it manufactures a food crisis. Because this is one of the main ways that Gazans have been able to sustain themselves. So when we talk about enforcement, this is one of my interview participants. I interviewed him after he was shot by one of these 50-caliber weapons. He had been going and he had been digging up old potato plants left by settlers and looking for potatoes in the ground. And during this time, he was shot in the leg and his donkey was killed, again, by one of these automated gun towers. Right? In addition, then, you have the whole question of sustenance and sort of this basic input of protein. Fishing is incredibly important. And as you can see, Israel enforces arbitrary fishing limits for Palestinians. So not only are Palestinians not allowed to go where the fish are, But the areas where the fish, where are they allowed to fish, is completely contaminated by the sewage systems that have been bombed multiple times by Israel. I think the last point I want to make here is one of the things to understand about this process, and I think this is very hard for us to conceptualize, is this is intentional. Right? The treatment of Gaza is not an accident. It's not a series of security measures. And one of the things that Gisha, which is an Israeli human rights organization, was able to prove is not only is there this whole consistent system of policies designed to sort of impoverish Palestinians, but in Gaza, they actually calculate the number of days, right? The number of days of food reserves left in the Gaza Strip before mass starvation occurs. Right? And this is the process of the siege, where on average the Israeli occupation forces try to maintain a four-day buffer zone, where at any given time there's enough food within the Gaza Strip to maintain Gazans for 4 days at just above the international limit for starvation. Right? So essentially 2,000 calories per day per Gazan. So one of the things to understand about this is in order to come up with these types of calculations, you have to maintain this incredibly precise system of surveillance and an incredibly precise system of enforcement. And the policies that Israel is putting into place in these regions are entirely designed to promote these practices. So I have much more to say, but not much time to say. So thank you very much.